Support for Classical Music According to Yehuda comes from the Lathrop Communities, serving older adults in the Quaker tradition for over 25 years, offering independent living on two campuses in Northampton and East Hampton, Massachusetts. Lathrop.Kendall.org. In this week's Classical Music According to Yehuda, Alan Chartok and Yehuda Hanani continue their conversation about women who influenced classical composers. Today they discuss Hector Berlioz and listen to a portion of his Symphonie Fantastique.
When I go to Tanglewood, which I love, and hear the Boston Symphony and hear your string quartets and Close Encounters of Music, there is nobody who gets brought up more that people know less about than Berlioz. I mean, professional musicians, of course, know Berlioz's work, Bernstein and all. But I think if you walked up to the American public and you would say, who is Berlioz and who were his lovers, you'd have a hard time with it.
Well, he was a very eccentric figure, a genius, of course, and was highly emotional, was very impetuous, a true romantic. Just to give you an illustration how impetuous he could be, he wrote an overture to King Lear after reading Shakespeare. And when it was badly received by the audience, he burnt it on the same day. Luckily, the burning itself was not a good performance. So it was rescued, published, and performed since. But that's the kind of a guy he was. The work that produced the greatest sensation and was inspired by a passionate infatuation is Symphonie Fantastique. He wrote it in 1830. We are in the same period as Mendelssohn, more or less. Early Romanticism. And this is really a sonic, spectacular melodrama. It is subtitled Episode in the Life of an Artist and is really biographical. It's autobiographical. The whole piece tells you the story of something that happened.
How many movements?
It's gigantic. It takes close to an hour and it has five movements.
Wow.
But it alludes to not one but two passionate love affairs.
Well.
So let me tell you the story because
I want to hear it.
It all is reflected in the music. If you're willing to give it an hour, we'll probably listen to the last movement.
Okay.
Just to get the flavor. The year is 1827, and a London theatrical company opens a season of English drama in Paris with great success. One actress, Irish actress, Harriet Smithson, who played Ophelia and Juliet and Cordelia, made a phenomenal impression on sculptors, on painters, on poets, on the public at large, and Berlioz was smitten by her. So Berlioz is in love, and he writes her, and he tries to have an audience with her, and tries his best. It's all in vain. And she writes him a note before she leaves back for London, saying, "There is nothing more impossible." Okay?
In a relationship with you.
Yeah, that's what she means,
gotcha.
Of course. Yeah. Nothing more impossible. In spite of this crushing message, he continues to fluctuate between hope and despair and cannot get her out of his mind. In 1830, he writes, and he wrote a lot. There's a lot of stuff that he wrote. "Oh, if she could, but for a few moments, conceive all the poetry, all the infinitude of such a love, she would fly into my arms, even if she were to die in my embrace." He has a very high opinion of himself, doesn't he?
Wow.
Tremendous narcissism. So, while he's tormented by this unrequited love, another young woman appears on the scene. Her name is Camille. And she becomes his new muse, the new goddess of his adoration and worship.
A lover?
Huh? Yeah. So, at this moment, he gains the Prix de Rome, the highest prize composers could get at the time, and they get engaged. So he is in Rome receiving this incredible honor, and he gets a letter from his future mother-in-law informing him that her daughter Camille got married to Monsieur Pleyel.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And Pleyel was the famous piano manufacturer and a musician.
And had some money.
And had a very wealthy, very successful. Chopin played on a Pleyel piano. Liszt played on a Pleyel.
Are there any left?
This was the Steinway of the day.
There's some
Pleyels still around.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So you can imagine his rage, his madness. It's like a volcanic eruption of this romantic man. Fury, threatening murder, threatening suicide. Time, however, cured this pain. And in 1832, he's back in Paris. And so is Harriet Smithson.
Oh, my.
Yeah, she is back for another production. The old flame of passion is rekindled. And in spite of parental disapproval and opposition on both sides, they get married.
Wow.
That's the story. Now, no one would know or care about this romantic melodrama.
Except for the five.
There you go.
For the five
Except
segments of the
that
symphony.
It created one of the greatest pieces of probably Berlioz or a landmark in romantic
and
music.
Both of those women have their own part of that, right?
Yeah. So it's quite a fascinating story. Symphonie Fantastique is indebted to these two ladies. Before we get into the story itself of what's going on in the symphony, I have to tell you some information that I want to share with our listeners is that the importance of the idée fixe, a musical phrase that represents a person that keeps appearing and reappearing repeatedly in different moments, in different shapes, different color, depending on the moods and expression of that moment, depending on the state of mind of the hero or what's going on out in the plot. The idée fixe in the Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz goes like this. It was Wagner who later on developed this device in his operas, following the hero through psychological variations. He called it leitmotif, which is really basically the same, the guiding motif that repeats and tells you where the hero is in the story. The piece, as you asked before, is an hour long, and Berlioz's explicit description of what's going on, the narrative, is pages and pages of words. So let's skip the part of his falling desperately in love and how the idée fixe pursues him wherever he goes. I mean, he hears it, he's in the country, and he hears it through a shepherd's flute, and then he's at a ball in the city, and he hears it through the noise, and he hears it through the dance, and this melody keeps haunting him. Wherever he is, he's obsessed with this woman, the love. Let's go back to the symphony. In a fit of despair, he poisons himself with opium, but instead of killing him, the drug produces horrible hallucinations and visions. He believes he had killed his beloved. He is condemned to death and is present in his own execution.
This is all dream now.
This is all the fantasy that is told in the symphony.
Sure, gotcha.
So an immense procession of executioners, soldiers, spectators is depicted in the music. The melody appears again, a last thought of love, interrupted by a fatal stroke.
Oh.
All in music. Next scene takes place in hell. Devils, witches are gathered to celebrate the witches' Sabbath. They call to each other from a distance. It's wonderful how he creates a sense of three dimensions in the music. From far away, you hear this, so they're gathering, all those devils and witches. Then the melody arrives, but the theme of pure love, this graceful theme, this idée fixe, this leitmotif, has become now a vulgar, crude tavern song. His beloved has joined the witches and is now a lewd prostitute, joining in the macabre orgy. The ceremony begins, bells ring. The choir sings a parody of the famous Gregorian Dies Irae. The witches begin to dance. They whirl and whirl, faster and faster, more and more violently. When the frenzy reaches a climax, combined with the Dies Irae, the vision ends. That's the end of this Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz. And I think we should hear as much as we can from the fifth movement, which is called, of course, The Witch's Sabbath.
A selection from the fifth movement of Symphonie Fantastique by Hector Berlioz. Before that, Alan Chartok speaking with Yehuda Hanani. To learn about Yehuda's Close Encounters with Music series in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, visit cewm.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.